if I go. So it's currently mirroring, which I assume is the reason. So if I go to... So, oh well, I can just present without the Q&A. Okay, so we'll just go present from the beginning. Okay, so I'm currently, the reason why I'm using a microphone is because we're streaming, just in case you guys want to watch this later or there are students who aren't able to be here. Where I'm going to try and Marish are going to try and stream and record as much of these sessions as possible. We're looking at trying to digitize as much of what we do and make it available in various ways and platforms, right? So we're trying, I'll try the forlistening.no. We also have a YouTube channel, Game Technology Lab YouTube channel. And yes, so forlistening.hig.no, I think it is. Yeah, .hig.no. And that's where the streams are. And so if we swap a... You can see it here. That is the site, and it should say Omnom Schedule, and you can see I'm this one here. And if I press F5, it's now active, so people can get stereo of me, both on their desktop and in reality. Right, okay, so... I've introduced myself to some of you who were here on Friday. So how many people weren't here on Friday? Right. That's quite a few. Okay, so this is the experience design course. I'm leading the course, partly because this grew out of the game design course that I created 8 years ago when I first started working in Jurvik. I'm a New Zealander, which is why I have a slightly strange accent. I spent 16 years as a lecturer, and in the middle of that, I spent 2 years working commercially. So occasionally I can refer to some of the commercial work I did in companies in Norway. I have a range of interests, and... I'm a gamer from way back, right? So I got my ZX Spectrum when I was 10, and so I've been a programmer for nearly 33 years. I did my first commercial work when I was 16, so I've worked as a commercial programmer before. I also have an interest in medieval history, so I think I'm also the most experienced siege engineer in Europe. So I've built more trebuchets, traction-based catapults kind of things, than anyone else, because I've built 10 of those. And in fact, I'm going down on the 9th to Denmark to build three of them for a Viking film, and they're going to throw fire at Viking ships using these. So I have other interests. I'm not just a geek gamer. We also have Mariusz Nowosowski, who is currently finishing off teaching the cloud course with Christopher, so he'll come over and pop up. He's Polish and spent 15 years in New Zealand. When I couldn't hire any good game developers with a programming background and a PhD in Norway, because it's really hard to get PhDs in Norway, because what you guys do is get jobs, rather than stick around and do PhDs. And so I had to recruit him from my old university. So I actually went and kind of, you know, headhunted him out of Otago. And so he'll come and introduce himself. Christian Franz, we headhunted him out of Otago as well, right? So he's actually the third Otago graduate lecturing this course. So this is now far more like a New Zealand course than it is like a Norwegian course. Luckily we have our Norwegian. He's a token Norwegian.
So I'm a graphic designer, and
So because this is more than just a technology course, right? Although a lot of you are doing a programming degree, it's important to understand that as programmers, what you do influences the user, right? So it used to be just game design, but now we've broadened it out to include a full discussion about usability. So this is the second iteration of the course. So although I created this course 8 years ago when I started teaching here, it was just about game design. For the last now 2 years, we've included Ivan and made it a broader course and more applicable to the two tracks that we have studying this course, right? Because we have a game track and we have an application track, right? We wanted to make sure that this course was engaging for both. So it's the department in this course and our work is focused on applied computer science, right? So as opposed to other degrees where you look at theoretical computer science and you kind of focus on algorithms and doing sort of strange things with computers, we're interested in how you apply that in the real world, how you interact with people, how you make games, how you make applications, how you make mobile apps, and the process of applying this knowledge, right? So we're an applied computer science group. Computers are used by people, right? So as a game developer, you can make an awesome game that makes the CPU work really, really hard. But CPUs don't buy your games, right? People buy your games, right? So you have to make an experience that's good for people. And for the app developers, right? If you make an awesome app, but nobody uses it and nobody wants to use it, and you can't convince anybody that it's useful, then it doesn't matter how clever the coding is, it won't get used, right? Or it'll lead to screw-ups, right? If you get the interface wrong, one of the ones that I was... Yep. So not understanding that people use your machines, not understanding the challenges that people have with interfaces is a problem. I mean, so when I was going through, one of the examples they used for us was an X-ray machine, right? So this was a real case where they had an X-ray machine and they has the big kind of device that comes down over a patient lying on a bed. The device comes down. In this case, a patient died because the user set the height to zero. Because in the user's mind, zero meant the lowest it could go above the patient. In the engineer's mind, that was on the table. So the machine just drove itself through the patient and killed them. Because the interface didn't explain what zero meant. Right? So, yeah, we don't want that to happen in your career, right? We don't want you to be responsible for that sort of thing. So understanding that people are using your applications and people are important is something we'll emphasize throughout the semester. As game developers, we're also interested in effectiveness and efficiency, and so we're going to talk about a lot of programming through your degree. We also talk some development programming through this course. We are teaching, although this is a design degree, a design course, we are a technical degree, right? So we're going to be implementing things, right? So it won't just be the static design approach, right? There is a similar course at fourth year in the design department up in Trondheim, which is a design course. Though, interestingly, they still use Unity and implement a game. When we talk about experiences, I won't just use games or apps. I'll also talk to you about your other experiences. You should be thinking about experiences in general. Right? Now, I've seen this described of game designers, right? That a game designer is kind of almost constantly looking at the world and thinking, like, how much like a game that is, or how would that be a game, or what game is that like, or they're kind of almost constantly designing games in their head around the world around them. And you get the same for designers, which can be annoying, because you guys notice when it's wrong all the time. Yeah, and it just makes you angry, right? So unfortunately, we're like, and my friend who did animation and graphic design, when he goes to Disney films, right, the first time he goes, he watches it with his technical brain turned on, because he sees all of the effects, he sees how they were done, he sees through the story into the technical of what was happening. And he can't enjoy the storyline unless he's kind of purged his brain of all of that the first time he watches it. And then he goes back and watches it as a fan, because he likes the movies, right? Because you get into the stage where you know so much about technique, and you know so much about how things are done, and when they're done well and when they're done poorly, that your brain triggers on those. And you can't experience something normally anymore, because you've been trained to see it in a particular way. So yes, hopefully during your course, we will break you in terms of playing games. Right? That you'll start playing games and you'll start seeing through what you're playing into the mechanics and the techniques, and start going, oh, that's just a cheap, that's just a cheap technique. Why are you using a Skinner box technique on me? Why didn't they do this? Or why is that shadow in the wrong place? Right? You'll start looking through the game and not just going, oh, this is awesome, but you'll go, oh, no, that bit's wrong, and oh, they should have done that here, and oh, wait a minute, I'm not playing the game anymore, am I? No, I'm designing now, right? So we will break you a little bit. But hopefully that then makes you better game designers, experience designers, application developers. It will also make you angry a lot of the time, so sorry about that. Yeah, sometimes anger is a good fuel for energy. Okay, so this course is split into two parts, with sort of the second part split into two streams. So we have a general introduction to design practices in general. All right, so the first part of the course, Ivan and I and Mariusz will be doing some teaching, and we'll talk about a lot of more general design, working in teams, documenting your process, understanding what you're doing. Then we break into two tracks. You are welcome to attend both, because they won't be running simultaneously, which are on a game development focused and an app development focused track. Right? Now, that means that we have, in the game track, we have designing a digital game and implementing a digital game. And the app track, we have building a prototype and then testing that prototype. Right? So they do similar tasks, one with a more focus on usability on a broader perspective, web pages, applications, and the other focused on game mechanics and player types and the kind of more game-specific content. So we'll get to that. You don't have to actually make any choice at all, except when you hand in your assignments and say, oh, I'm handing in a game assignment, or I'm handing in an app assignment. You don't have to decide what track you're in or anything like that to choose at this stage. Ah, and there's Mariusz. And Christopher, see? So now the New Zealanders, or ex-New Zealanders, outweigh the Norwegians. Right. So we have two textbooks, because we have these two focuses. So, foci. Jesse Schell's book, which is A Book of Lenses. Now, one of the things I want you, when you get this book, and I see you have one, yay, right here. In here, there are a lot of lenses, like lens 59. Under lens 59, there are a group of questions. And those are types of questions that come from that perspective. And so this is one of the things that we'll also be emphasizing this year, is thinking about taking perspectives and thinking about things from other people's point of view. Thinking about it from your player's point of view. Thinking about this type of player or that type of player, or what this person's trying to achieve. In the usability, they talk about personas. They talk about looking at universal design, right? So these perspective taking and questioning is important. Stephen Krug is the other with Don't Make Me Think. It's the revisited version, version 2. And so that one is crucial reading for anyone doing the app track, though you should really read both. The Krug book's not very large, so it's quite small. And yeah, that see, it's tiny, right? It's like, you know, it's not a huge amount of reading. It is more focused on usability, particularly web page usability, right? Which hopefully all of you have used web pages. So you'll have some experience. It's one of the challenges I see at high school education is when they ask you to like read a book and do compare and contrast, you're comparing it to the other books you've been told to read at school. And so a lot of people don't actually have much to compare and contrast with. Whereas if we ask you to do stuff on web pages, you've used a lot of them, right? And if I ask you stuff about games, a lot of you will have played more than one game in your life. Even if that's chess and Scrabble and Bejeweled. So, as I said, core structure, we have lectures. We've got four projects that you'll do. First part of design, we have that second half split. The exam, we have a multi-choice section with a confidence in, marker on it. This is part of my metacognition teaching, and we'll teach you much more about that through the course. And you select 6 of 9 short answer questions because there'll be 3 short answers from the common section, 3 about games, and 3 about user interaction. So you have to pick kind of the 6. You can pick from anywhere, though. I don't mind which 6 you pick. This is our current plan. You don't have to remember all of that. That's because that will change. But we do have a plan. Right, so be reassured that we do actually think ahead and we're trying to make sure that this is going to work. And I don't know if Christopher's seen that I've put his name down in a couple of places here. And you'll see that one of them, like week 6, I have as the word digital. That's because all of us are going to be away that day. So we're going to try some of the flipped classroom activities where we're going to record us talking about stuff and see what we can do digitally and online with you guys and get your feedback on whether that was as good as coming to a lecture. Right? Because we want you to learn about how you learn. And, you know, if you help us decide what kind of YouTube video we should do, should we do the right beside while we talk, should we do the talking head version, if you guys can help us out with what you would like us to do for a digital lecture, then we'll try that one out and you can give us feedback on that as an experience, right? Because this is an experience design course, and so we're going to create different experiences for you, and so we'd like your feedback on that, right? So we're going to try that in week 6. Okay. So experiences, I've used the word quite a few times already. So what do we mean experiences? Well, experiences, things that happen in humans, right? We know there are experiences in animals. We know that there are some sort of consciousness in animals. I think they've just shown that chimpanzees can learn to play rock, paper, scissors. And they can use some tools. But yeah, so chimpanzees can play rock, paper, scissors at about a 3 to 4 year old level. Right? So, but apparently they have problems understanding that paper beats rock. Apparently that's the hard one for them. So I understand scissors are quite good, but yeah, so there are multiple types of experiences we talk about, right? We talk about experiences that are about the external world, right? So when you go out here and you stand out and I look out my window and I see a beautiful lake view and I experience the view, right? My kind of consciousness is looking out at the world. I can also close my eyes and think about stuff, where the experience is happening entirely internally, where I'm just reflecting on what I know and I've reflected on things that have happened to me or that I'm currently thinking about. Those are both experiences. Now, as a game developer, you can control some bit of that. You can control some of what's coming out of the screen. but the rest of the experience is happening inside the head of the person playing your game. And there are some really strange things that happen in people's understanding and experiences. I was just reading two days ago, that language understanding, right? So as a New Zealander, we have given away our vowels for some reason. I don't think we got like foresight or anything by doing this. But when I say chair and chair, I say chair and chair, not cheer and chair, right? Because in English, a chair that you sit on has an A in it, and going chair, yay, and cheering has two E's. New Zealanders say it chair and chair. There, there, and there, beer, beer, beer. We say, like, you have to know everything by context when listening to a New Zealander. What they found is a difference between understanding New Zealanders and Australians, right? We have quite similar sounds. They did a test on people, and if you put a kangaroo teddy, little wee toy, in the room while the person's listening to the sound, they'll interpret it as the Australian word, and if you put a kiwi in the room, they'll interpret it as the New Zealand version of the word. Just based on the environment they're in and the toy that happens to be in the room while they're listening to the sound, even though it's an identical sound. So there, the experience isn't about the thing that's happening on the screen or the specific thing you hear. It's about what's happening in your head, right? So one of the things that we're going to talk a lot about is psychology, right? Understanding people. They're horrendous. People are difficult to understand. We're going to have to work on that. Designing experiences, right? We're going to talk about going from just responding to things, right, and experiencing things, to actually starting to choose the experiences other people will have. Right? And you can think about that everything from this lecture, right? You can think about what has been designed about this lecture. So one of the things is like the seating tier, right? That height and the way in which it's tiered back, those were all designed around me standing here and talking to you. The streaming has a camera up there that covers about this area of the board, assuming that all lecturers stand here and talk, which means if I go and stand over here, the people on the stream now can't see me, right? So I can make rude signs at them, and they won't know. the experience is all designed around what you are experiencing sitting there. Now, if I come through here, and because I'm wireless, if I come and shimmy along, if I come and sit here and start lecturing from inside the room, this is quite a different experience. Certainly different for you because you had to move. But now I'm a member of the audience rather than the lecturer. This would be a very strange experience to be lectured from within the room. You can do this, right, where I actually take the mic and we pass it around and each of you talk and present some part of the lecture and we pass around the clicker and you can go forward and back. So we could do that, but that's not how this room is set up, right? If I go up there, you guys at the front here have to turn around and strain your neck, and it's not designed around me sitting there. It's designed around all of you looking at me. I have some problems with that because I much prefer where you guys get to see each other. So I much prefer sort of semicircular lecturing environments where I get to stand in the center and you guys are looking at each other much more because I want you to talk to each other about the course. I want you to see other people learning, right? Because that helps you understand the experience they're having. At the moment, you get to see the experience I'm having and I get to see the experience you all are having, but you don't get to see each other. Right, so it'd be quite nice to have that kind of seeing what I see in there. So we can look at how you design lectures. We can look at designing the set for a band or a stage design or websites or how you buy things online. All of these are kind of interesting design decisions. I could get a mirror. I have actually, and I've got a game which I play with a camera and a beach ball, which I could probably bring up, though maybe not because I haven't tested on this machine today. So it might not work, but I could do it in the break. So I don't know. I was at the Rima Tusen last night, right? And when you go to a supermarket, have you ever noticed that most of them don't put cladding on the ceiling? You can just see the rafters? Do you know why you can see the rafters? No, that would be a good answer. No one cares? That's not quite right. Oh, that was also no one cares. Apparently, if they put in nice finished ceilings, people think it's more expensive. They do, right? They think if you put in the ceiling, it's more expensive. So they rip that out to make it look like you're going to a warehouse and therefore you're getting cheaper product because they've not wasted their money on making the room look nice. Right? Even though it's more expensive to leave the rafters open. Right, because they lose more heat out of them. It's harder to insulate. They have to spend more on heating, so it's much more expensive to show you the rafters than to actually put a roof in. But it's people's perception that it's cheaper if you're in a warehouse that makes people think, "Oh yeah, okay, that's good. There, I must be getting the best prices because I'm in this shitty building." Humans are. They elected Donald Trump. Humans do seem to be a bit strange, right? But that's the thing. As part of game design or part of experience design, you can't always assume that humans are going to be perfectly rational agents and going to do what you expect them or want them to do, right? And so that's part of our design. Now, this is the mother of tech demos. So this was a demonstration of the first mouse. So you guys have all used a mouse, and you probably don't think about the design of a mouse. When I was it's a pretty low quality video, but when I was tutoring at university, one of the interesting things that I found is so I would go around and see each student and see how they're doing in the course and get them underway. And it took about 25 minutes, 30 minutes to get around the students. And one of the last students I came to, she was sitting there using the mouse. And I said, "Oh, that's interesting," because she'd seen the mouse. It was the first time she'd seen a mouse. Right, so this was in the 90s. And so she'd actually used the mouse with the tail towards her. And so she'd been using it, mouse inverted. So left made the pointer go right, right made it go left, up was down and down was up. But after 20 minutes, she was working perfectly comfortably with the mouse, completely inverted. And because it was a Mac mouse, it was a single button mouse. And so she was just clicking the button with her palm, because that felt like the natural thing to do. So in 20 minutes, she had become completely comfortable working with the mouse round the wrong way, right? She just thought, "Oh, well, it's a bit strange, but I got used to it." And I said, "Okay, well, try it the other way. It might be easier." And she went, "Oh, yeah, it is." But this idea of intuitive interfaces and trying to find interfaces that work for people also adapt to the shitty interface you give them, right? And there are some things that we forget how bad they are because we're just used to them, right? We're used to them being difficult, so we don't even question them, right? So we're going to look at some of those and some, you know, bad game design decisions that we've just got used to. Now, two tracks, games. We're going to look at the engagement and experiences as a whole, and we're going to look at web pages and the applications. In games, one of the differences is your player is there for the experience, right? If you don't have a good experience, you don't have a good game. Just end of story. If the person is there to buy a ticket on the train, on the NSB app, you probably don't want the experience so good that they decide, you know, "I'm going to buy another ticket because that was such a good experience buying a ticket. So I'm just going to buy two or three of them because it was so fun." That's usually not what you expect people to do with your product purchasing application. You want them not to get stuck, so they get halfway through trying to buy a ticket and then go, I can't find what I... Good, I'll just walk. So those are kind of different thresholds on the importance of the experience. In games, the experience is it. You're usually not trying to achieve something else. In applications, there's usually a secondary goal. Right? And this is one of the things that you'll experience through your education. Because you guys are here to learn a bunch of stuff, get a degree, and hopefully get a good job, mostly. Right? Which means we, as lecturers, don't have to be as good as the movies. Right? Because if you have a choice between like coming here to this lecture or watching Wonder Woman, and they were equally valuable to your degree, then there's no way I'm beating that, right? I'm not that engaging, right? So we are only competing in a being good enough to make you hang around and not just walk out. One of my colleagues at Otago, he failed this task relatively badly. He had a class of 90 students, which is about the size you are, and 4 weeks in, he had 2 students turning up to his lectures. Because that's how bad he was, right? So yes, you can make a desired experience so bad that you guys just won't show up at all. Usually about 10% of a class will show up. Even if I put a tape recorder here and pressed play and walked out, 10% of you are likely to stay and listen to the tape. Right? Most of you will leave, but 10 of you think, maybe you'll come back. I have told students that I'm just going to be giving a recorded lecture and it will also be streamed online. And yes, 10% of students still turned up to the lecture room to watch it then because, you know, they had time. It wasn't quite just the tape deck on the desk and me walking out because I haven't tried that one. Maybe I should. See how many of you are willing to leave after I just walk out. I might get into trouble for doing that. Yeah, so you have to understand that in games, they're there for the fun. You guys are probably here to learn something, right? So I have to give you more. I have to give you education, but my experience doesn't have to be quite as good as a movie. Though, you know, hopefully I can be reasonably entertaining. Learning should be fun, yes. Learning itself. So one of the things I talk about is education, right? This whole thing you're in now, is a gamification of learning, right? Because learning is fun, but society wants you to learn specific things. And so we put this points, badges, leaderboard, right? So we gave status, right? So we have like grades, and we have comparisons, and we have universities versus Hochschule, we have bachelor's, master's, PhD. We've got all this kind of game mechanics around learning. So learning itself is fun, but we've kind of incentivized you. One of the big problems, and one of the things that I don't experience here in Jørvik as much, but in Trondheim, one of the lecturers was saying, yeah, students are so lazy. You know, unless you make it mandatory or give it credit, they won't do anything. Right? And that's because they've set up their whole system to say, no, you play the game of education. You're not here to learn stuff. No. You're here to pass the exam. Right? And as soon as you've passed the exam, you can forget everything I've said, right? Because obviously none of it's going to be useful. So once you're in that mode of education, once you're playing the game of being here, that you're no longer interested in what I'm saying because your first question in your brain is this in the exam? Right? Once, if I drive you to think that, then I've failed as an educator, right? I've made you play the game of education rather than learning. In fact, one of the things that I say is for my external for this course, I do not give him or her a marking sheet to say what I expect the answer to be. Part of the reason I don't do that is I don't want you guys to try and second guess me, to try and work out, now what would Simon think the answer to this question was? Right? Because I don't want that to be how you learn. I want you to answer according to what experts would think. Right? If you can find resources online that say, you know, this particular aspect of game design means this, you use what the experts say, right? I will try and be consistent. I will try and teach you about reality. But the best I can do is kind of, you know, what I know and what I can learn. And I don't want that to be what the only thing you learn is about what I think. Right? So yeah, I want you to be more than that. Okay, so what is a game? Now, I will actually get you to do some wee exercises in a minute, but what is a game? Well, games are older than computers, right? So you guys have been playing games probably all of your life that you can remember. Not necessarily computer games, but certainly tag, chasing games, playing with a football, and my kids play on the trampoline, and they'll play fighting games, and they'll play chasing games, and they'll turn activities into a rule-based set of actions with an objective. Right? And so if you look at games, you can try and work out, you know, how do we define games? How do we know what the difference between a game is when we talk about tag, soccer, Counter-Strike, World of Warcraft, Candy Crush, Hearthstone? How do we make a difference between a game and real life? Is education just a game? Is war just a game? How do we distinguish between things which we think are definitely games and things we think are definitely not games? So, when I talk about game design, most of you are probably thinking computer game design, but the second assignment will be a board game, because board games are games. When we define a term like game, I need to communicate with you, right? So, we need to have a shared definition of what we mean by a game. So, what do you think is the difference? Right. So there's something about fun in there that if it just has rules and objective, right, you know, work. I come to work. If I'm a factory worker, I have a bunch of rules around, you know, I can put this here and I can lift that up and I put it there and I do this. And I've got an objective to make as many bottles as possible. Is all actions games then? I think, yeah. So that would be failing. Something around fun. Right, so the goal of the activity to have fun, and I think aspects of games from the class. Right, so this is where I was going to go here. Yep. Okay, so I'll just... Wait, give me my... Why is it not... it is giving me it, it's just not showing it. Okay, so we have focus on... fun, and so the goal is to be tortured in Dark Souls, but so it's still something. You have objectives, but you also have an objective of fun, right? So you mentioned fun, and so an objective of fun. So the kind of sort of focus on fun / intention, engagement, other words, challenge. Yeah, I suppose okay, so this is one of the things, and I think the textbook makes this mistake several times, right? The difference between a good game and a bad game, or a game and not a game, okay? So, and I think fun might be one of those, right? Because I can make something I might call a game that's a really boring, dull, bad game, right? But I still want to call it a game, even though it's not fun. Because it's just a bad game, right? So sometimes when you have a set where you exclude something from a set, saying, well, this can't be called a game, it's clearly outside, there's also things within the set which still might be games, and it might be bad games. Entertainment, right, so fun and entertainment have, I'll put it up here because... if I can spell. Entertainment and fun are related, right? But there's something slightly different about those two. Yep.
Yeah, and so one of the things I'll pick out there is actually lowered consequence, right? So when so the difference between actually doing it in real life and role-playing it is that, you know, you're not using actual bullets where you die. So lowering the consequence of something that often is yep. Achievement and progress. So a sense of progress is important. Yep, that's we like progress. It's very good. Yep. Achievement and status. So there is this idea of status, giving you badges or a certain level of importance, or seeing yourself like beating someone else. So I'm better than you at that crazy thing. Now, unfortunately, guys in the room, we are slightly more vulnerable to that than the women. Particularly if you, one of the standard phrases we have in New Zealand, and I'm afraid I will use occasional New Zealand phrases, pissing contest, right? So with men, if you put a line on the wall and wrote plus 10 points above it in a bathroom, there'll be a bunch of men who'll go and go, oh, yeah, I can get over that. Because we're disgusting. And also, we're very easily swayed just by points and being, can I piss higher than you? Right? And in fact, like in the medieval, so I'll go back to my medieval time, the Crusader kings, when they went out to the Crusades, one of the competitions they had was how big their trebuchets were, right? How big their siege engines were. And you both, as a king, you want to have the biggest siege engine, right? But then they had to work out how you work out how powerful your weapon is, right? And because rocks are all different sizes, and they didn't really have scales, what they did is they ended up measuring their trebuchets by how far it throws a dead horse. Because horses were about the same size, and when they died, you'd put them in a trebuchet and fire them into the castle to spread disease. Right, but you know how far back you could be and still throw it into the castle was their measuring contest that the kings used to say, "I'm the best Crusader king. I've got the biggest siege engine." Right, so it's not new that we compete on points, but yes, this idea of status and achievements. It seems that men are just a little bit more easily influenced on average by getting more points. Women have worked out that the points don't mean anything. And so, why would I worry? But again, whenever, and I'll bring this up now because there is news media about it. Whenever I refer to men and women, when I'm talking about kind of men are like this, women are like this, I'm meaning 70%-ish of men and women. And actually, the traits that you have as a person overlap in a lot of ways, right? So I have some very female traits. I talk about how I feel far too much. So in several relationships, my girlfriend at the time has said, can we just not talk about how we feel for a while? So, yeah, I overshare and I talk too much, right? So, which is often considered a female trait, but it's one I have, right? So it's not that men are all like this or women are all like this. It's that we have particular traits. On average, women express these set of traits more than these set of traits, but any individual, no idea, right? So certainly, and one of the things that I'm going to hammer on you guys for the whole 3 years is whenever you're dealing with an individual, you look at the individual you're dealing with, right? Doesn't matter what clothes they're wearing, what hair makeup they have, how tall they are, what genitalia they have, right? None of that matters. You deal with the individual, right? Because the individual will have skills and experiences that are relevant to your group or to your needs or to your experiences. So don't use stereotypes to kind of pigeonhole a particular individual, right? My wife particularly says, I'm never allowed to use me as an example because I don't fit most pigeonholes. One of the and just before I give my time over to to Tom, one of the, you know how I said I did a programming job when I was 16? One of my other jobs when I was 15 was selling makeup door to door. So I sold Nutramedics. So I did the full training. So I can do your cleansing, your toning, your foundations, your concealers, your lipsticks, your lip liners, your eyeliners. I was even trained to do the colorization of what you should wear, what particular colors suit, what season of tones you have in your skin, and what kind of foundation movement you could use to lighten your face and give a smoother complexion. So I can do makeup, right? It's just kind of, wait a minute, but you're a geek. How can you, so I don't fit, right? So anytime I talk about men and women, I don't mean any particular person in here, because I will not make any assumptions about how competitive you are or how laid back you are or your hygiene or anything about you, because you're individuals, right? And I expect that of all of you for each other, right? Treat people as individuals, see what they're good at, and then work with them. When you're designing for a whole group, right, when you design for a game for teenage boys or you design a game for teenage girls, then, yeah, you start looking at averages and you start looking at things in general. But as individual developers and working with each other, treat each other as individuals. Right, now, before we take a 10-minute break, I have Tom who will give out boxes to the Bachelor in Programming people. Right, so Bachelor in Programming, who are actually the people who are doing our full 3-year degree, we have some mugs for you, which we're supposed to give out on Friday. But we forgot. So we're going to get those people to say, the rest of you can get up and kind of walk around and go outside and have a break for 10 minutes, and we'll see you back here at 17 minutes past. And the B-Prog people, do you need to say anything more than that, Tom? You also want to say something? No. Nope. Yep. Yeah, so the Bachelor in Programming people stay. The rest of you can go up and kind of wander out, and we'll hand out some cups to the Bachelor in Programming people.
Som vi ja, enten glömde på fredag, men som den harde kjerne. Ja, Sterten, du her? Ja, de har jeg mot deg, for du meldte fra på forhånd, så du på du fullt inne. Den god. Nå har vi spørsmål om timeplanen og hvordan det var vanskelig å finne opp. Hvis dere melder dere opp, semesterregistrerer dere, og melder dere opp på både utgivning og eksamen, så kommer de fart opp til utgivningen. Så få gjort det. Fristen for utmelding på utgivning og eksamen, det styrer tilgang og sånt på Blackboard-rommet, og det viktig. Altså, hvis dere oversitter 50 sekunder, så får dere ikke på personen. Så gå på nye studenter i informasjonsdelsen og få meldtekst der. Det opprettet, så vidt jeg har fått litt av fadra, og det veldig bra. En Facebook-gruppe,
klassa får en representant in på tale kampens sak och att vi är där i tillsatsmöte. Det må vi ha på plats. Jag nämnde det för Elia. Det är klart det är väldigt raskt, väldigt tydligt nu. Bokkeeper nästa år som kommer på plats i alla fall. Det må gärna köra och lansera kandidater och debattera det ute på Facebook i morgon. Och företa ett val antagligen Simon Mamba. Du är Simon har det igen. Det är väl lektion om måndag.
There's been changing in the timetable, yes, and though we asked for that from week 9 or something, so there will be eventually a slot that we will use on Monday. But not the time.
When will you have your class next time?
So we have Friday. We'll see these guys again on Friday.
Okay.
And then on Tuesday.
Yeah. På fredag, velg tillitsvalgt da. Det är deras representant, det är deras fora. Hör gärna med Henrik om någon av de klassiker som var med sist. Han har sittet i tilltal og som ligger i den rollen hvis noen av dere ønsker å ha fremdelskandidatur og være med på det. Velg et tilltal på en vare og gi meg navnet på veien. Greit? Fredag på Simon sin timer så velger dere det. Der det. Baserommet sa jeg. A254 veldig viktig. Det negative med det at det veldig mye tilkallet. Det er proppet med studenter her nå. Mandager fra 12 til 2 det ledig. En time, to timer. Onsdager fra 12 til 1, demokratitid. Og fredager før lunsj det to grader. Prøv å bruke det. Og etter klokka 4 så det stort sett ledig der hele tiden. Og dere har adgang, kast dere på det og bruk det. Så baserommet, ta det i bruk. Det noen som har noen spørsmål, noe dere lurer på? Administrativt? Det skal ikke jeg ta, ja.
Jeg synes ikke hva det kostet
her, det
på
vei. Gå ned på IT-kjelleren og ta det der. Ta bilder på deres kort, så vi får dere inn i arkivene. Så det viktigste, jeg vet ikke helt, men...
Yeah, okay.
people use them because they've learned to use them, and I could actually show them on the screen. And I play them, and I love them.
You love them, and you did too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
When do you start?
Probably another about 5 or 10. I was thinking that if you want to have a longer talk, then Friday night. This is how long your talk wants.
3 to 5 minutes. That's a
basic. Yeah, well, that's what I originally suggested, but
that's a music medium.
Yeah, he's interested in playing with the way he's meditated on motivation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I upload my screen and get out of them.
this lecture isn't on YouTube at the moment. It is on for listening, Pigliolino. So Game Technology Lab, GTL. If you look up GTL in Jervik, you probably will find it on. And we have a bunch of our YouTube videos up on there from all over the curriculum. So we've got one up from the cloud computing yesterday. I have a bunch of my serious game stuff up there. There's mobile, there's research stuff. There should be about 150, 200. Right, okay. Yes. Hmm? Yes. Yeah, okay. Go for it. Okay, so we also have. So I said yes, so you can. Yeah. Okay, so just to introduce Marish, stand up, wave. But that's Marish. He'll be doing some of the lectures. He's Polish with New Zealand tendencies. Or are you now New Zealander with Polish tendencies? He's both. Christopher is there. He's going to be our other lecturer as well as Evan. And we have Anisi here as one of our tutors. Bjorn was hanging around down here. He is also going to be a tutor. And Anisi wanted to introduce himself and give a short talk about how, why he's so enthusiastic and motivated. So,
yeah. I'm going to put a final on this, because I'm very good at talking. So I wanted to say two things. First of all, I want to enable you to do more complicated stuff than you are currently learning in this semester. So I'm trying to push for being able to learn new Android and being able to learn new Unity game engine. But this is only for those who feel very confident in the stuff they're already doing. It may happen like in a month or two, and I might have to do it for free if I don't get funding. The second thing I wanted to talk about was, I consider myself the optimistic part of this team. I mean, great, I've challenged a lot by Simon's enthusiastic, eternal, glowing smile. Which is also very infectious. But I think I win because of one perspective which I have and which I want to share with you, because I think it's a very rich perspective. Everything that you do, every piece of line of code you do, which is you haven't done before, all the other things that you apply, they are all a little piece of empowerment. All of these things will make out over the course of the 3 years, will make out a huge toolbox which you can use to create all these amazing things later on in your life. The kind of stuff which you play today, you won't be able to make those things right now. There's a lot of things you need in your toolbox. But every little thing you do, all of those tiny pieces, they seem trivial right now. Every one of them matter, and every one of them gives you a lot of power in the long run. So what I'm saying is celebrate every line of code that you write which works, which is new. Because every single line of code matters in the long run. It makes up your toolbox. And the reason why I'm saying this is because you might not feel like what you're doing now matters, but it really does. It really does matter. That's what I want to say.
Right, now I'm supposed to put this back on. Now you sent it to me, and I clicked on it, and then it disappeared.
Okay, we'll fix that later.
We'll put all the contact information will be on Blackboard. Okay, so now the streaming people can hear me again. One of the reasons why I'm wearing this is for the stream, right? Because it only has a limited microphone, so otherwise you get the pictures, but nothing about what we're saying. Right, so thinking about games. Sorry, I went off to that diversion about individualism. Some of you may have been reading the stuff in Google about like the Google coding stuff recently. You've seen that in the news? There's a few nods. Yeah, it's a challenge, right? And you can see that in this room, right? There's a lot of guys in this room, right? There are more than 50% of you are men. There are some issues around diversity in development.
Thank you.
Okay, right. So that's exactly the position that has raised an issue, right? Now, it is worth talking about. And as I said, I am willing to talk about anything you guys are wanting to talk about, right? Now, we will move on the lecture shortly because I don't want to stick too much time on this. But as I said before the break, here we treat people as individuals, right? So the biology is actually more to do with the kinds of traits you are more likely to express, but you don't know those necessarily just by looking at someone's body. I mean, there. So, for example, one of the things I found very interesting is human chimeras. Have you guys heard of human chimeras? Yep. So human chimeras are when you can have two sets of DNA. And my daughter is potentially a chimera because when my wife was scanned, she had one baby and two placental attachments, right? So there were two placentas and one child. That would usually mean there were twins, and one of them just vanished, right? So about 10% of pregnancies are twins, about 1% of births are twins. So 90% of secondary secondary attachments disappear. Now, some of those merge, and you get people who have both, like two sets of DNA. Some of those are male and female DNA. So they are themselves and their brother in the one body. And some of them have striped, so you can have your liver have stripes of different DNA in large stripes. If you get a merger between 2 and 64 cells, you get what's called two-siders, where one half of the body is one gender, the other half of the body is the other gender. They see this in birds, right, where you have a male bird with beautiful big plumage on one side and brown sort of normal plumage on the other, right? So these happen, and they happen in humans, and we generally don't notice them. So the person you're talking to may actually be both male and female at the same time, right? So all the kind of binary nature of biology and things, yeah, the individuals just doesn't work, right? So for individuals, we don't use it. As you say, for populations, right, when we say, you know, there are 70% men in here, why is that, right? Why is a good question to ask, right? And what I want you guys to do is ask questions, and it's perfectly reasonable to say, why is it like that? One explanation could be biology would be one explanation, but you'd have to have reasonably good evidence for that. One could be general sexism in particular phases through school, through the population, through sort of gender coding of things. Like, there's a whole bunch of like weird gender stuff and usability that you guys might not have thought of. As I said to some of you on Friday, is how tall is a kitchen sink? How tall is a kitchen sink? How do they design how high a kitchen sink should be? Here. They're about the same height. So a kitchen sink and a kitchen bench should be at a comfortable working height. And so do you know how they worked out what a comfortable working height was? They used the average height of women, right? And so actually it's less comfortable for men to work in the kitchen than women on average because the... I know! Isn't that shit? So that's a stupid way of designing things, but that's one of those subtle gender cues that you don't necessarily notice. That isn't, you could argue, oh yeah, it's biology. The answer is no. It's our response to biology, right? It's not that kitchen benches have to be this high, which is biologically means women are supposed to be in the kitchen, right? Our response to the biology has meant that they have this particular height and this tendency. Yep.
Okay, so last, very short. Yep. It's very hard to step outside of our own cultures, right? And so seeing the world from someone else's perspective or seeing someone's from no perspective. And this is something we'll talk about in understanding usability and understanding designing for users in mind, is that how do you step outside of the culture you have, right? It's kind of just very hard to be outside of any culture, right? And so when we're designing things, when I was teaching at Otago, one of the things I did is I was teaching polymorphism, right, and object-oriented. And I went to one of our female lecturers, and I said, okay, this is the example I would draw up for polymorphism, but I don't know if that's gendered or not, because I don't know, because I'm me, right? And so I asked her to develop an example to teach it from her perspective, and then I taught her example, right? Just because, you know, I don't know if the example I'm coming up with is gendered. I can't step out of myself and know that, right? And so sometimes you just have to rely on other people to identify things for you and try and get that bigger picture by getting more people's perspectives. Okay, so now we're going to move on, though I'm happy to continue that debate at another time. We are all going to have to include exfil at some point in the future in our degrees, and this is the sort of thing that I want to put into that degree, right, into the philosophy part of a degree. Okay, so aspects of games. So we've got a good number of aspects of games. Have any of you been reading the textbook? So you haven't quite flicked forward through. So yes, that's actually a pretty good list that covers a lot of what you would think of as being the stand. Oh, did that? Okay, so of what we would normally think of as being. Where did they go? Okay, I'll try again and see if I can make it show them. Ah, okay. Sorry, it has animation turned on. An example of an experience. Is this the experience you want, where I press play and step through? If you've ever been overwhelmed by PowerPoint, I don't know if you guys have like death by PowerPoint, where someone uses all of the fly-ins and music and candles and reveals and sparkles and... Yeah? Yeah. It's an experience. I'm not sure it's the best experience. I tend not to use animations in my PowerPoint slides. I will use Prezi with you guys, so if you haven't seen that before, just as a different way of presenting. We'll also use Kahoots, and we'll use various other tools and discuss ways of interaction. But at the moment, we'll start with a standard lecture, and then I'll get progressively weirder through the course and through your degree. Okay? So if you're willing to stay around, we can get quite weird by the end of the degree. Okay, so we had all of these things. Now we have to think, okay, so there are two types of definitions. There are definitions that are inclusive and definitions that are exclusive, right? So it's not often not good enough just to know what's included in a class to define it. You also have to be able to say what's not in the class, right? So if I just say, you know, games are activities that have rules, that's a little bit too inclusive, right? Because then everything a rule I'm going to call a game, and at that point game doesn't really mean anything, right? So I have to find ways of using some of what we think these aspects are to try and make some distinctions between games and stories. So some games have stories, some stories aren't game-like, and some stories are game-like. So stories are different to games. Puzzles, are all games puzzles? So what we have is a Euler diagram, Euler diagram. Do you guys say Euler or Euler? Euler. Okay. So we had it Euler in New Zealand. So Euler diagram. And you know the difference between an Euler diagram and a Venn diagram? That's a terrible colour. Does anybody know the difference between an Euler diagram and a Venn diagram? Have you heard of Venn diagrams? Have you heard of Euler diagrams? No. Okay, so just a quick bit of math, because we also teach math. That's a Venn diagram. This is a Venn diagram. This is now an Euler diagram. Venn diagrams have to show each of the potential overlaps of every set. All right, so once you get Venn diagrams of four intersecting things or five intersecting things, you start getting weird kind of shapes that do this kind of thing, where they have to find ways of building each interaction only occurring once. Right? And that then becomes a Venn diagram. As soon as you have a subset relationship, you're actually talking about an Euler diagram, not a Venn diagram. Now, that's kind of strange. Why would you have terminology like that? Well, terminology allows us to share understanding more quickly. The reason why I want to talk about games is, and know what, so you know what I mean when I say game, and know what I mean when I say puzzle, is that we can then talk more quickly. And so when I want to use Venn diagrams as a mathematician, I have a whole bunch of knowledge behind that you then trigger by saying Venn diagram. And so if you mean Euler, then you should use the right term. So is games and puzzles, if that's puzzles and that game, so is it that all puzzles are games, or are there some puzzles that aren't games? Right, so where does the puzzle sit? Is it inside? Are all games a form of a puzzle? Which way around does it go? Right. So because for you, this area of game, because it includes that fun aspect, right, it's got to have something kind of entertaining or interesting, whereas a puzzle could just be a challenge, you'd be comfortable saying that puzzle is like this, where there are some puzzles here which might not be fun and might not actually be entertaining or engaging in the way that a game should be, but you'd still like to call a puzzle. And whereas a whole bunch of puzzles that are actually games. Is fun entirely subjective? I'm going to have to say yes. this would be an argument that we could actually have with Marish in the back there. Is fun entirely subjective? Yep. So we agree on that. That's good. Sometimes Marish and I will disagree. And one of the things I'm going to make you do when we disagree, and he might even disagree if all puzzles are games or not, is that you guys are going to have to disagree with us sometimes. Right? I want you to disagree with me. So sometimes you're going to have to choose between Marish and I when we disagree. Okay, yep. Oh, right. Okay, so you put the person in an awkward situation. They're not having fun. It's not a game to them, but it's a game, or it's fun to you because you're sadistic. Right. Okay, that's getting a bit meta, right? So here you kind of have an activity that's clearly not a game, right? But for some reason, you know, pulling the wings off flies aren't a game for the fly. It might be a game for the boy who's doing it. Yeah. Maybe girls do this as well, I don't know. I know I know young boys do this sort of thing. But yeah, so here we have what's kind of levels, right? And what's the game? Meta games and sort of meta activities. One of the examples I use in this area is the Olympics. The Olympics is a game that countries play because there's a leaderboard, which is the number of gold medals you win as a country. And your strategy is how much money you spend on different sports. Right? So the Olympics is actually a game countries play against each other. The activities within those are sports that individuals play or teams play against each other. But they're in the context of this larger game being played by a different entity. Right? So you can kind of work out kind of what layer there is a game at and who's playing the game and what kind of entity it is. There are some interesting discussions I've had on can countries play games? Because they're not a single entity, so could they be doing enjoyment? Does a country have enjoyment, or is it just an activity to get re-elected as a politician? And so, yeah, but so there's a lot of kind of discussion around those terms. Yep. So yes, you can argue that a country is the sum of its parts, and therefore if the people are being entertained, then yes, the country is entertained. So if you guys all want Norway to get more medals, therefore Norway is entertained by you winning medals. My mother used to be opposed, like she didn't care about the All Blacks, the big New Zealand rugby team. Most of you guys don't know what rugby is. So she used to be opposed to it. And then about 15, 20 years ago, she started cheering for the All Blacks because she found out that when the All Blacks lose, there's a 50% increase in the number of women admitted to women's refuge. So men beat their wives when the All Blacks lose. So my mum started cheering for the All Blacks because she wanted them to win so that people wouldn't be beaten up, right? Which is a sad indictment on our society, but, you know, what motivates you as an individual? What does a country celebrate? When does a country feel anger and pain? Yeah, could be related to games that they play and sports. Right, so we think puzzles might be games and puzzles. Toys. What's the relationship between a toy and a game? A toy has no clear win state. So, you know, if I'm just playing with a toy, I don't necessarily have any kind of objective that I'm trying to get to, or I go, oh, I won. It's just a toy. Not all games. So again, we could argue, can puzzles be toys? Yeah. So toy and puzzle probably have some overlap. And there'll be some games that are puzzles and possibly toys. So it might be that we have this set. So there are some things that are toys that are just purely toys and not games. There are some toys that are games but not puzzles. And there are some toys that are puzzles and games, and there are some puzzles which are toys. Right? So you could think of these as all having overlap. Now, when you're trying to explain something, working out, like, is there anything actually in this space? Right? Are there toys which are puzzles that aren't games? You can then start filling that up and kind of look at how you understand the world and how you categorize the world and how you think about the world and find relationships. Are there features of this set where all puzzles that are not games but are toys share something, right? Is there some underlying mechanic going on? Is there something that if I wanted to make one of these, I could look at the other things in the space and go, oh, okay, so they all do these sort of things. So when I design it, when I make it, I should look at how people understand and how they interact with those things at the moment. So tools versus games. Well, tool could be anything. So yes, my son will use a hammer sometimes as a toy. We try and avoid him using a hammer as a toy because they're pretty dangerous. Though he has a plastic hammer, which is clearly not functional, but is still a toy. So he has a toy that is a tool that's no longer a tool. And so also like Photoshop, you could consider a tool, but then you could make a game out of Photoshopping. Yes, paint. And you made a game out of it, right? And did you see like the website where you could like fill in a single pixel. And then people were fighting over trying to make flags and... Yes. So it kind of... It's a kind of collaborative environment, and then suddenly it turned into competitions and objectives and rules about how to do things and people trying to achieve things. So yeah, even like things that might have originally been a tool could turn into a toy if... a tool could become a toy, could become a game, may even turn into a puzzle. So all of these are related. And when we talk about them, we have to sort of start thinking about what are these distinctions. So when we talk about tool, what would we need to make one of the distinctions between a game and a tool? So how would you define used? You use it to achieve something, to do another thing, right? So it has a function, right? So a tool has a function that it performs, right? Tetris doesn't really have a function it performs. Other than burning time. Utility. Yes, excellent. Tools have a utility. They have a something that they do and is useful, right? So the utility, the use of. So here when we talk about tools, we say, what is the use of it? You could take a tool and turn it into a game, right? Partly by losing some of that utility, using some of the function. And so when we talk about design and we say, what is some of the difference in your attitude towards design and games versus websites and applications? This utility aspect, right, and the usability, we'll talk about designing tools, right? Because it's a website to buy something. That's designing a tool, not a game, a tool. Yeah, and so you can take something that was a tool, definitely a tool, and convert it into something that is now loses its utility of putting in nails and then becomes a toy because it can't do its utility function anymore. One of my favorite examples of a tool becoming a game is SimCity, right? Because SimCity was actually the city building tool for a bombing game, right? So an aerial bombing game. And so Will Wright needed to build cities so that he could bomb them, right? And so he started building cities so he could bomb them with his plane. And then he spent all his time building cities because that was so fun. And then like other people in the team started building cities because that was more fun than blowing them up. And then so they went, wait a minute, we've got something that's fun here. Maybe we should release our building tool as the fun activity. Angry Birds. Angry Birds was their physics testing system, right? Because they had moved to using 2D physics from their previous games, their previous platforming games, because they had like 40, 50 of them. They'd introduced a new physics engine that they wanted to use. And so they built some testing for it. Right? And they were just seeing, how do we test our physics engine? Right? We've got to, knock things over. Okay, well, how do we knock it? Well, I'll have something, that I can click here and it will release something and knock it over. And then they just spent their whole time, finding ways to playing tank and knock over the block of sticks they had. And went, wait a minute, this is more fun than the game we were designing. How about we release the tool, the testing tool for our physics system, as a game? Right? So sometimes you can build a tool and find it so fun that you release it as a game. there are kind of interesting turning things in to other kind of fun activities. You get the same with translating back and forth. You keep going multiple Google Translates is something to see what it ends up being, weird language. And then you can go all crazy where you try and turn games into tools, where you use games to teach things. I think one of the one of the strangest ones I've seen was using Minecraft to teach about Auschwitz. And so they'd built Auschwitz in the Minecraft world, and then you'd go in and you could flick the switch and turn on the flames, and you could put like drop the gas into the chamber and watch all the villagers die, and then you could take them and put them in. It was just, oh, strange, right? Because my mind doesn't like, you know, fun, Minecraft, creative, lovely, Auschwitz, kill the Jews, learn about history. Ah, my brain doesn't work anymore. It was just a weird juxtaposition to put something that's so kind of creative and fun against something so horrific and disturbing, right? And so it is, it's a strange thing to see. And I'm not sure I would use Minecraft to teach about Auschwitz, particularly not when you can turn the gas chambers on and off. And, you know, it even had, it's strange, there was the area you had to decorate the cabins, right? You go in and you could like put pictures up in the cabins that the Jews were staying. It's just weird, right? It's just, no, don't. So sometimes you don't make everything, you don't turn a game into anything, and sometimes you don't make a game of everything, right? So when we talk about gamification and making games, some things you probably don't make games out of, though that is potentially quite a limited set, right? Because I'm willing to play a game on almost anything, but there'll be a bunch of people who will be offended. Okay, so let's quickly go through some of these. So, story. So, textbook definition, some of the definitions, an account or recital of an event or a series of events, either true or fictional, right? So people try and come up with definitions. One of the fun games to play, see, I can turn a game into things, is to look at definitions of things and find something that a group of people say, yeah, that's definitely a story, but doesn't fit the definition, right? So can you defeat the definer of this? And you'll find that for almost any definition of games, you will be able to find a game which you say, aha, this is a game and it's not in your definition. Or you'll say, aha, this thing fits all of the things you've said in your definition, it's not a game. Right? And that's partly because there are kind of two categories to the definition. And you can kind of think of them as two layers. You have the inner circle where everybody agrees everything in here is a game. And everybody agrees that things outside of here are not a game. Right, so definitely yes, a game, definitely not a game. And then all of this area, which is kind of fuzzy. Some people call them games, some people say they're not games, some fit the definition, some don't. Right? Ideally, if we all agreed, there wouldn't be any of this. Right? You'd have a nice, clear definition. These are definitely in, these are definitely out. Unfortunately, most of the time you get this fuzzy space. Right? So you're not going to be able to make those clear distinctions. However, we will try and still use story to mean a sequence of events. Right? Now, there are two types we'll talk about, embedded stories and emergent stories. Embedded stories are generally what the designer or the narrator wanted the story to be. Right? So when I tell a story, I have an intention of what my story should be. There's emergent narratives, which is you, as an audience, create a new narrative on me. Right? And so when you see people building a narrative around Tetris games or around Bejeweled, or they build other narratives and they build narratives around their experiences that weren't embedded in the actual experience, they were emergent. They came out of the interactions. Right? So creating those emergent... Fan fiction often has emergent narratives, some of them quite disturbing. very disturbing. But they're not there by intention of the designer. They have emerged out of the interactions. Okay. Toys, so we're happy that toys... simple definitions, things like an object for a child to play with. It's kind of almost self-referential saying a toy is something you play with. And children do it. But then, you know, you can't have adult toys. And then you go, well, maybe you can have adult toys. So maybe that doesn't work. Right? So any time we give you a definition, you can certainly argue with me, right? I wouldn't use an object for a child to play with because there certainly are toys like Ferraris that older men buy. And they're not really there for utility. They're there to play with, right? So they're a toy. And, you know, when does a toy become a game, right? When does a soccer ball go from being a ball to being an item in a game, right? When does a Barbie go from being strange bits of plastic to being a Barbie game to being some disturbing variant of Barbie? Rules. Rules are an important aspect to turning a toy because a toy has some of that aspect of fun, right? When you talked about fun, right? Toys have that kind of feeling of fun, so they need something else to kind of move them into games, and rules are one of those, yep. And an objective. So if you add rules and objective to a toy, by it being a toy, you get some of that fun and engaging activities, and then you turn it into a game, right? So sometimes it's not creating it from scratch, and what in the textbook, one of the guys, Jesse suggests one way to design a game is first make a toy. Make something that's fun, and then build a game out of it, right? Because adding rules and objective to something that's already fun is easier than taking something that is really awful and trying to make it fun. Adding fun is really hard, right? You'll find this in lectures. When you have a really boring lecturer, you'll have to find ways of engaging your brain so you keep listening to him. That's really hard work, right? It's a challenge to turn something that's just an activity into something that's fun. So it might be easier to take something that's already fun and turn it into a game. Any question? Okay, so anything you play with is a game because you play games. Okay, so logically that doesn't quite follow, but so because it says, like, so if there is a thing that you play with, right, so if we're going to do this in propositional logic, so how many of you guys, did any of you get taught, like, proper logic notation at school? One person got proper logic notation. Two. Okay. No. Things like, if I draw this properly, you probably didn't get this, you know, for all X, so let's say play X implies game X. You've never done any of that? Right. Okay. So you've seen this before. Yeah, so a couple, probably some of our international exchange students may have seen some of this. Yeah, you've seen a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Usually it's even more boring than this. And one of the problems with maths is that they don't use exciting things. They generally use very abstract, boring things. So games and play. So explaining that, you know, if you say something is a, if it's a game, if you play with it, then it is a game, right? Then you say that there are no such things that you play with that aren't games, right? Now, it probably isn't true. Because I think I can think of some things that I could play with which aren't a game. They're just me playing with something. Right? But I like the intent, right? The intent is to say the playfulness is an important aspect of game. Well, so what you'd so how I would reverse this logic is not say if you play with X, then X is a game. I would actually reverse that and say, if it is a game, then by definition, you have to be able to play with it, right? And so there's a whole bunch of stuff on logic where you reverse the order of the if-then consequence, right? So we can discuss that later when we get to discussing propositional logic and proper logical forms. But can you play with all games? I would say yes, you can play with all games. So all things are games, have some way of interacting and have some aspect of play in them. So I'd say I would agree with that, yep. And now we've come full circle. What is a game? So, what is inside this that we all agree is a game? Okay, so can we is
Does everybody agree that Tetris is a great game? Who says Tetris is not a game? Great, okay, so Tetris, definitely in here. Okay, think of something that's not a game. Most people, going to a funeral. Is going to a funeral a game? You've got some fun dead mates. So is going to a funeral game? Okay, so funeral might be close to the edge here. So funerals are just outside of what a game's, okay? But most of us in the room accept that most funerals are not games and that Tetris is a game, right? And now we start thinking, like, is SimCity a game? So who says SimCity is not a game? Okay. So we have at least one, which means SimCity lies here. SimCity, in some aspects, is more like a toy than it is like a game, because the original version didn't actually have objectives. However, when they released it as a game, they gave you objectives, right? And they gave you a score, and they gave you kind of, oh, when this city is destroyed, do this, right? So there is a kind of overlap between toys and games, and when we start deciding it's not really a game, it's just a toy, right? So you can start kind of feeling out where you think things are a game. So basically, what is a game? Well, things like Tetris are games. Things like funerals aren't. And unfortunately, because we're humans, that tends to be the most accurate we can be, right? Because we all disagree on different aspects of things. And so in this class, we're going to use definitions. And so when we talk about games, I mean things with rules, right? I mean things with objectives, right? So you have an objective that you're trying to achieve. You have rules, that they have an element of voluntariness, right? It's something none of you mentioned yet, is that you choose to play a game, right? If I force you to do something, it's no longer a game, right? It's now a task, or it's your job. It's no longer a game unless you have some aspect of wanting to do this, right? That it should have some form of lowered consequence, right? So that, you know, part of the reason why this isn't just a game, right? Being here isn't a game, is because failing means that you take longer and it costs you more money to get your degree, right? So some of the consequences aren't actually zero. They have a bit more consequence than if this was just for fun, right? So there's usually some form of lowered consequence in a game, which is why war, where people actually die, isn't really a good example of a game. It's a game to people who have no consequences, right? So if I'm sitting in a bunker and I'm just moving things around and other people are dying, there's still lowered consequences for me, right? Because I don't really care. But if for you, as a soldier on the front line dying, it's not a game, right? Because you're dying, right? So that sense of lowered consequences. Yeah. Okay, so I don't consider gaming or gambling is gaming, right? So I actually don't like the fact that they stole our word, that they call themselves the gaming industry, because they're not games, right? They are Skinner boxes. They're gambling, right? Particularly if you look at the one-armed bandits, the spinning machines, and things like Texas Hold'em, right? Which has no gameplay. It is merely betting. Yep. What about poker? Poker has some gameplay. Yes. So poker is still a game, but once you add a lot of consequences, it starts losing some of its game-like features and now becomes a job. Because there are a bunch of professional poker players who are no longer playing it as a game. They are professionals. Okay, so. It starts to become a job. So it has this kind of fuzzy set mentality. It moves from being just a simple game to starting to mean other things, right? So when a professional footballer has been playing football for 10, 15 years, it may not be that he feels like he's playing a game anymore. It's his job, right?
So there is actually, but for other people, it's still a game, right? So it changes according to kind of how people are playing it. Yeah, so it, and this creates this fuzziness of the set. Usually when we talk about games, we will mean lowered consequences, right? I don't particularly want you guys developing gambling games, right? In Norway, there are some laws against that, specifically. You can only have games of skill, not games of chance. And there's a whole bunch of limits on the amount of money you can deal with. And so we are mostly going to be talking about what I would consider entertainment games. Oh, so much gray, right? This is not a simple black and white decision, right? We've already talked a little bit about puzzles. In a real current, yes, all of that gets very gray, right? And you know, gold mining in, like, so, wow, gold miners, are they really playing a game or are they doing a job? So puzzles. When I talk about puzzles, is there something missing? Should there be a win condition? A particularly baffling problem, a toy that tests your ingenuity? Puzzles, one of the things that when I talk about puzzles and we talk about puzzles, one of the things I'll be adding is that there is some relationship between the problem and the solution. So a special kind of game where there is a single answer or set of answers. There is a correct answer. So a puzzle should have a correct answer, right? Otherwise, it's just a random challenge. So it should have a correct answer. And in this definition, all puzzles are games, right? Now, we decided as group that I need to change that and go escape and go most. Puzzles are games. Yeah, that's what we agreed as a group. Okay, well, we'll change the lectures. That's now what the definition is. Right? Do games that deal with moral dilemmas fall into as a puzzle? I wouldn't think they're specifically a puzzle. They could be puzzling, but I don't think I'd call them a puzzle. I would call them a dilemma. Right? So a dilemma has multiple options. Dilemma genres aren't common. One of the things I want to do, actually, is work on moral dilemmas and make the ex-phil course, the philosophy course that first years are supposed to take, where you play through the world and you have to get to the right ending. So you have to get to the utilitarian ending by playing the utilitarian philosophy through the pick-your-own-path game. And then you have to get to the Kantian imperative ending. And so you kind of have to play particular positions so that when you come to a dilemma, you pick the right decision for the philosophy you are currently playing as. Right? So I'm thinking of a role-playing game. Because currently X feels a bit boring. Sorry, I shouldn't say that recorded. Someone will play it back to the philosophers and then they'll send their philosophy hit squads and... You know, I won't turn up on Monday. So over here, it's the philosophy hit squads that have come and got me. Now I've mentioned them as well. No, first rule of philosophy hit squad, don't talk about philosophy. Okay, so we talked about tools now. It's 10 past. We should give you another break. It's actually 10 past 3, not 10 past 2, as that says. So I should give you another break, or I can just keep going and leave earlier. Keep going, leave earlier, or break? Okay, we've got about 50-50. We'll have a short 10-minute break, go to the toilet, come back, and then we'll finish off. Okay? And I'll say sorry to the philosophers. I don't want to be taken in the weekend.
I'm really nervous about this expo thing.
About the?
Expo thing.
Expo? Oh, X-Fill. No, you guys don't have to.
Okay.
No, what's happening is that NTNU has decided that all students will do X-Fill in the future.
Okay, good.
Okay, so you did X-Fill somewhere else?
No,
okay.
But
Okay, so what should you, oh, sorry, I can take this off.
So you've already done the degree somewhere else?
Yeah,
okay. Okay, it's all right. So,
we had a student last year who has a course in game design, has a bachelor's degree in game design and interactive media, and came and had this course, and he learned a lot of new different things and different.
And certainly, I have a different perspective than a bunch of other designers have.
And I was kind of really, no, I want to do the art. I don't
want to
do the design.
Okay, so you did it for the art focus.
Yeah, just
So you went did your master's degree in Middlebrook, and then but you're from Norway. And so you come back. So this is a programming group.
Yeah.
Right? So this is going to be an interesting move sideways.
It's going to be wrong when I say forever, because back half the time when they call it NTA. Well,
I have to say, one of the reasons why initially I called this the game programming, which is still a bachelor of programming, is because programmers get jobs.
And you have to learn about really hard to design for the jobs.
I think
we do not do this. We wear
a top.
Is that the reason? I thought it was because all the scientists. It's because that until.
And you've got the jobs,
guys.
So certainly, because if you do your core studium and pick the right courses, then you've done exactly the same first year as the game course. So you can just come in. And then halfway through second year, then we start making choices when you go into either graphics or application development halfway through second year. So you've got time, right? And you know, it's worth learning programming and seeing if you like programming. One of the other things is. But there are actually a lot of different ways of understanding how to code. So if you're not finding the explanations work for you, right? So like
this
heading
will give you
right,
all lectures
from
this campus.
Then
yeah,
we can look at, because I've got some
HIG and NTNU.
Different
guys,
ways. I've got some friends who have gone through as programmers who have more of an effective approach.
Yeah. Right?
So they actually kind of see things in a different way. Struggling.
Yeah.
It may not be that you're not good at this. It may be that it's
correct
in a way that doesn't really good. Right? So if you are having that problem, do come and chat and find the resources.
But
yeah.
I did the math course this summer to actually get
something.
The teacher there was like, oh, there's several ways to
solve that. But that is a recurrent course.
There's just one way, but I'm starting to learn that.
Like, no argument.
Yeah, well, so one of the things that I try and do, and
talk
with our tutors about, is trying to and yeah, I don't know how well this is done here, but work out what your current
is
and then use that to build
living in
specific
Sweden,
work,
in
right?
So
one of the challenges, like, Frodo quite likes football, so a lot of the numbers are football dumb, right?
I know.
So if you don't like football, it's kind of but there are a lot of
like
other ways of looking at the world. So if you do need some help, just come and ask what we can do.
I've given up.
Programming
here. No, how important the editor. You learn to program some people.
I'd seen it. I didn't actually get the time to play it, but I watched other labels play it.
Right. There's built in anti-check where you don't understand the solution for the puzzle. End up in a situation where the game forces you to understand the mechanic in a more lab-like setting.
Right.
And the moment I saw that, I was in that kind of design world.
Yep, you went, ah, I know why they do it.
Yeah, exactly.
It kind of pulls you out.
Yeah.
Immediately. So one of my favorite examples for a user interface is how, as a game developer, right, if you're doing a flying through game or you're doing a 3D game, how do you deal with mouse input, right? Who likes flight simulator mouse versus direct control mouse, right? How do you make that choice, right? Because usually it's a setting somewhere that you go in and get. Of course, that pulls you out. So what Halo did was, when you start as Master Chief, you ask to look up, and then whatever you do with the mouse or the joystick is what up means. So it says look up, and if you pull down on the joystick, down now means up for you. That's how you choose mouse input. Right? And as a designer, you see that sort of thing, oh, that's clever, right? But in the play, you never notice, because you just never have to set mouse input. And you never think to ask, why didn't I have easy mouse input? Because you're a player, and you never think about it, right? As a designer, you start thinking about that sort of shit, right? And it gets in. Right? And yeah, as you say, it resonates that whole,
that's
cool. Yeah, and that's what I like, right? I like that sort of thing. Okay, right.
Tools. Okay, so what in the end of this course, as I was just asked by one of the students, are we going to make games, like digital games that you need to program? Yeah, you're going to program games, or you're going to build apps. Some of our students last year went completely crazy with their mobile prototypes and decided to use React Native and actually program up in JavaScript full mobile apps and release them on the Android market and have them downloadable by the public and go completely crazy. That's fine too. If you want to go crazy and learn more stuff, that's all good. But yes, you will make games. As part of making games, even the app we're going to make you make, well, you don't have to make a board game, you can make a paper prototype, but we're going to get you to edit the rules of the game. Now, part of the reason why I'm going to get the application developers to edit the rules of a game is it's easier to change a small thing about an experience that you understand to feel how a rule changes an experience with a game than just changing the color on a website, right? Which is kind of, it's hard to measure that change in experience. Whereas with a game, if you change one rule in a simple game like chess, you can have a radically different experience of the game, right? So we're going to, that's why we're going to look at some games even for the application developers. So games are interactive, right? So we're going to design around interaction. We're going to design around choice. One of the things that games are really good at is giving you choices. If you have no choices, you might be reading a book, right? Because stories don't have choices. You just follow what the story is, right? So games, one of the things that we're going to do is designing choice. In this course, I'm trying to add more choice to your curriculum. So we're going to do some of that with our assignments. We're going to add more choice. Games will have objectives. They'll have rules. One of the things we didn't mention is they'll have boundaries. Right? So where is the edge of the world? This is slightly contentious, as in it used to be clearer where the edges of a game world were. But now with Pokemon Go,
Where is the edge of the game world? The planet Earth. There are no Pokemon on Mars that we know of. There might actually be. I don't know if Google has placed Pokemon on Mars. GPS, global positioning system, you probably won't get a signal. So you're probably out of, you're probably like down a hole. So yeah, so there is kind of, while there is reception to the GPS system is the boundary for Pokemon Go potentially. Yeah, probably the most expensive Pokemon ever captured. So boundaries are an interesting challenge, right? So the boundary of chess is quite clear, the boundary of the board. The boundary of a boxing, if you go into boxing, you're inside the ring, you're allowed to hit each other. You're outside the ring, you're not allowed to hit each other, right? So there's a nice clear boundary. Except if you go into like WWE, and then like you are allowed to hit each other with chairs, and you are allowed to hit each other outside of the ring, sort of, but it's an act. So it's a play more than it is a game because everybody knows what's going to happen. So, right? So again, grey, lots of grey. But when we design these experiences, we will look at interactions, choice, feedback, objectives, rules, boundaries. We're going to discuss these with rules. We're going to look at things like the rules that help you define what a game is, right? When you change the rules, you change the game. So for chess, if I change the pieces to aliens versus predator, right? And I have a wee bunch of aliens and like the alien queen and kind of characters from the aliens movies, right? Like turrets and towers versus like predator and jungle creatures. If everything moves like chess pieces, it's still chess, right? Because the rules are the same, even if the aesthetics are different. And certainly, the narrative of chess is horrendous. It, like, the whole ability to sacrifice your wife to make another man inconvenienced. Because you don't even beat him, you just put him in checkmate, right? He doesn't even lose, he just gets an awkward situation he can't get out of, right? And, you know, you're allowed to kill the religious leaders, you're allowed to kill peasants, all of which are probably female, because when they get to the end, you can turn them into a queen and marry them. So you're allowed to like sacrifice female peasants whenever you like, so long as you inconvenience the other guy. Right? That's a horrendous story. Right? That's not a narrative you want to ever live by. Right? But we don't do that. We look at the rules. Chess is about the rules, not about the story. Right? And when you change the rules, you potentially change the game. Right? So when we change these rules, and when you guys, in the first assignment, you'll take a game that you know, and you will change some of the rules. And one of the questions is, has that changed the game? Is this now a new game because you've changed some of the rules? Okay. And there's this idea of the magic circle, which is, you know, like the boxing ring. When you step inside the ring, I've changed rules and now I can hit people. And I step outside the ring and the rules change back to how they were in reality. Okay? So there's this idea that in games there's a kind of separate area with a different set of rules. We're going to talk about feedback. We mentioned feedback down here as being very important in games. We're going to talk a lot about feedback, how you give feedback, what feedback means, feedback mechanisms, scores, like you know, revealing of things, status, achievements. All of these are part of feedback. And we're going to use feedback to discuss winning and losing. And one of the things I want you to focus on as designers, both for players and for users, is what does the player do, right? So if you've got a, if you're making a game and you think, oh, I'm going to do a Viking game and it's going to have these weapons and it's going to have these amazing scenery and it's going to have this amazing troll creature and you haven't actually talked about the game bit yet. You haven't talked about what the player does yet. You've just been describing a story, right? And that's one part of making a game. But if you want to talk about the game, you talk about what the player does, what they actually do in the game, right? That makes it a game. When you talk about user experience, you don't necessarily talk about, you know, all the amazing crypto stuff that's happening in the background to secure the user, right? No, that's like, those are requirements that the user doesn't necessarily know about. It's what I do to get to what I need. Right? So think about the user and what the player does. We're going to talk about interactions. We're going to talk about affordances. Now, I find the door over to the B building. Have any of you been to the B building yet? No? So you might have lectures in the B building. It does exact opposite of that. Right? Which is weird. Right? Because you have to grab the handle and push with the one that has the handle, which is for pulling. It seems weird that you would make me push the one with the handle. Because if you don't have a handle, you can't grab anything, therefore you have to push it, because it's the only option you've got. Which, so, when we talk about the world, one of the things we talk about is the natural interfaces. Now, if I do a blue underlined on a web page, you guys are going to click on it. If you click on it, it doesn't work. You get annoyed. Right? And so we're going to talk about natural and artificial interfaces. We're going to talk about affordances, the way that you engage people in your world, and show them, you know, what does a wooden crate mean in a game? Smashing loot. Yeah, kick the wooden crate and it smashes. And there's stuff in it which survives you blowing it up or breaking it or shooting it from a distance. Like, why does a bullet from a distance make a crate explode and reveal a potion that floats in midair? That's just some weird physics going on. Normally, if I shot a crate, the bullet would go through it, smash the vial of potion, and leaving the crate intact. Right? But no, this is just weirdness. But we all know that a crate means loot, right? So that's an artificial affordance. It's an artificial natural way of doing things that you guys have all learnt. Right? It's interesting when you put a non-gamer in those spaces and they don't break any of the crates because they don't realize you're allowed to break crates. If you go around, well, normally you'd open a crate rather than smashing it, right? Normally, if I want to get something out of a crate, I don't pick it up, smash it on the ground, going, get out, get all the stuff out, and then hope that the stuff remains intact after I smashed it to get... You're shooting it, going, shoot it with a machine gun, hoping that it will fall open. This would be a bad lesson to have learned from a game. So, all of those, like, natural ways... One of the things I always find bizarre is how intuitive double jump is and changing direction while jumping, right? Because double jump, right? So when I run and go, I can't do a double, I can't get a second jump in there, right? I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do to go jump and then kind of jump again to get higher. How does that work? when I jump and somehow I can turn around and go back the other way by jumping out and going up, and yet you guys all do it without thinking. You've just learned it's okay to jump and change direction in mid-flight. Makes no sense. Invisible jet boots. We appear to all be wearing invisible jet boots in games, and yet we all accept this as being normal, right? So that's where we look at interfaces beyond just reality and look at what are conventions in games. Certainly, there are different rules in games, luckily. So what I want you to do, and I'll end here, is my mission for you, end of the day, I'm finishing a wee bit early, but that's my intention, is I want you to think about experiences you are having now and experiences you're having over the next week. And I want you to, and we're going to do this in small groups because we're going to be in the atrium on Friday. So we'll put you round tables, and I want you to talk in your groups about, I want you to think about the experience you're having. So pick a particular experience that you have over the next week until Friday, right? And your homework is to step outside yourself
And rather than just enjoying the music that you're listening to say, okay, was there a person who designed the particular experience I'm having right now? Right? And think about who was the designer of your experience. So certainly if you've gone to a concert or you've gone to a bar or you're having a coffee, you can start thinking about who designed the cup, who designed the table, who designed the outside environment, who designed the street you're in. Think about the people who were involved in designing the experience you're currently in. Right? Think about how that experience might be improved. Start thinking about, okay, is there anything about what I'm currently experiencing that is kind of not quite right, annoying me, that could be done better? Is that improvement just for you? Right? So, yeah, I don't like this particular thing, but does everybody find this bit thing annoying? Or is it just me? Right? And write it down for presentation to each other on Friday. So, I want you to think about who designed the thing, can it be improved, and is that improvement just for you, or is it more general than that? Right? So, it could be a game that you're playing, it could be you going to a bar, it could be going out to one of the concerts. Just pick an activity, and on Friday we'll discuss those activities. If you pick more than one, then you might find it easier to discuss because you might find someone else who's picked the same experience. Ooh, the experience is sleeping. Ooh. I think getting into bed, right, so you could look at the bed and think, okay, someone designed this bed, right? So someone designed the bed, someone designed the sheets that you're in, someone designed the room that you're in, possibly the lighting configuration you have, your alarm clock, your mobile phone that you use to wake yourself. All of these things were designed, right? So you can think about, well, you know, what were they thinking when they designed it? Right? So I want you to kind of think about your experiences and start trying to dig into your experiences beyond just kind of what's sometimes called level one, right, where you're just responding to the world. I want you to actually think about how this came about. How did this experience occur? Yeah, your parents could be involved in designing your environment to try and convince you of particular things. Sleep itself... Okay, if you really wanted to get quite crazy with that, you could talk about... Okay, so just as an aside, because I've got like 2 minutes left. My PhD is on the functional purpose of REM sleep in mammals. Right? So why mammals dream, basically. So that's what I did my PhD on. I did it on neural networks, on associative memories, and looking at how you have a dreamlike stage to encode more information into an artificial intelligence system. So I did a lot of studies on dreaming and on sleeping and the value of sleep. And what's nice is that you're getting more media now about the dangers of not getting enough sleep. And in fact, there is... So... Premature babies are 50% more likely if you have poor sleep patterns. So if you want to avoid a premature baby, try and get more sleep. There are various illnesses associated with sleep, Alzheimer's sleep that goes, you start getting low quality sleep before you get Alzheimer's decline. Obesity, if you don't get enough sleep, you start making bad food choices. Your food choices, if you decrease your sleep, you are more likely to pick fat and sugary foods than healthy foods if you haven't slept well the night before. So obesity is linked to broken sleep patterns. So, sleep well. It's really, really important. And who designed that? Well, I don't... It was kind of evolution just happened. But, yep. Well, that depends. Okay, so I know myself that I need more sleep, right? Which is partly why I'm in the obese category, because I'm not getting enough sleep. I would like to sleep more than I do. I tend to work too hard is my problem. I tend not to play games because I'm usually working, unfortunately. I need to get more sleep than I currently do. Sometimes I'll be grading assignments through to 1 a.m. and then I'll be up at 6 again. So 5 hours is not an unusual amount. You will notice if I have had less than 4 hours because I start to struggle to be coherent, which I blame on the sleep. It could be just that I'm like not very coherent anyway. But I get much more tired with less than 4 hours in a night. And I tend to try and do some recovery in weekends, but I shouldn't do that. I should be sleeping 7 hours a night. Okay, so there's so much research to talk about, and we can't talk about today. But yes, there are some issues. I've had programmer students who have a 26-hour day. So I had one student who moved his sleep 2 hours every day, and I put the watch on him, and you see it cascade down, and then skip, and then cascade down and skip. Right? His brain was set up on a 26-hour cycle, not a 24. And we know that the average human is about a 25. Right, so we are actually, our bodies are not quite aligned, because when you go into space, and astronauts living in space, when they do a natural sleep cycle, they end up around 25 hours, not around 24 hours. So we're not actually particularly well designed for this world, for some reason. So it would be a bad design if it was designed. So programmers do have some problems sleeping, though it's very hard to tease out the reasons for that. Right. Okay, so do you have any questions for me before I let you go on this lovely, now sunny, afternoon? Okay, so homework for Friday is to think about the experience you're having, think about can you improve them, and who designed them. And we'll see you on Friday morning in the atrium. Okay, have a great afternoon.
I mentioned you, but sorry. I was doing that as you asked that question.
All right, that's
great. I was planning to do the upload. In fact, I just unplugged so that I could do it without getting caught by like putting in passwords on the stream, because the stream's still going.
All right, thank you.
But yeah, no, they'll be on Blackboard.
Okay.
Do you know who Mark Rosewater is? Mark Rosewater.
Rosewater. All right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He talks a lot. I've heard him talk. He has a podcast. He talks a lot about game design, especially like the user, because they like designing cards. Like it's kind of they have been designing the card for 20 years and stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They kind of like being able to like make new type of card like for so long.
So Magic has like a whole, like it's almost its own interesting kind of sub-area, right?
Yeah, because like with every new set, they're like making a new game every time, because like...
The interactions are so complex.
Yeah. I really like that game.
So Magic cards, you can find good and bad Magic cards and combinations, and people digging into combinations and seeing those combinations, because there's so many now. It is. It's a very interesting place. And yeah.
We also recommend that, like, if you want to design, you have to, like, take a game, like, whatever, you know, just by changing it.
It's the first step, right? The first step is to start changing experiences and seeing what effects small changes have, right? So one of the things we'll do is we'll play rock, paper, scissors. And we do some alterations on rock, paper, scissors that make it very interesting. So with rock, paper, scissors, so I can play. So one of the interesting things with rock, paper, scissors is you can change a bunch of very simple rules around it. You can change the experience a lot. Not just, you know, lizard box where you add additional things. But so for example, you do paper gets one more point. Right? So you think about throwing paper. But then because we're both using by throwing paper, then you're like, if I'm looking to get 2 points, you're going to use scissors. But then I think, okay, if we're going to a certain number, like so if we get 5, right, and I get 2 points of paper, if you've got 4 and I've got 3, paper will win. So am I slightly more likely to get paper then? Oh. You okay?
Yeah.
So you can do, and that's just that simple rule changes the way you think about what the other person can do, right? And then we also do things like nomination of the person, right? So we'll start with 10 paper, 3 plus 1. And then what we do is before we throw, we nominate something. So I say paper and you say box. If you get 2 points of rock and I get 2 points of paper, and then we get to throw.
Oh, okay. Kind of tight.
And then you can say, am I bluffing? Am I going to say the thing I just said or not? So you can do breaking some of the symmetry, breaking some of the rules, and seeing how that changes how you feel about what's going on in the game. Because normally rock, paper, scissors feels random. Right? But once you start changing it and making it asymmetric, it's now strategy rather than random. So rock, paper, scissors, yes, is, well, actually, no, you can beat the random.
The thing is, you just go around in circles and you're just like, okay, this.
The prince is bright.
You just have to stop it.
Yes. You've watched The Prince is Bright?
No.
You should watch The Prince is Bright. You need to see that. But yeah, it is The Prince is Bright. But you know, you've got a challenge here. And I can show that video actually when I do the rock, paper, scissors exercise. But no, we'll play with that. Okay, for this course we don't use the physical book in the game, right? I'll have to check this to see if it's still true. Amici, were you guys able to take in an A4 sheet of paper into your digital exam this year or not?
You see, this came from me because I sent it to you.
Right.
For
we don't have the book. Right. We don't have the book.
We were not allowed.
Right.
And the digital exam you made was based
on that one, so it probably has the same rule.
So I think there is.
So. I'm not entirely happy with that, but anyway, that's the only time.
How long was the exam?
4 hours.
Hmm?
I think 4 hours.
Yeah, for 4 hours, it would be very difficult if you had the notes. So I don't.
It's the only traditional exam I do. Is this one? And
what do you mean traditional? All the other exams are different.
All of my other exams from now on are not that style of questions that you write down answers. So in this one we have a written exam, which is actually now on computer, but it's written exam. But we partly kept it because it's more consistent for a bunch of students coming from high school, and they've been taught about exams and how to do exams and all the other things to do exams. So I don't want to go completely off piece immediately.
I just completed high school as well, and your exam does not
feel like any of those.
Any of the ones I had before.
So you can tell me, was it good or bad, or what did you think?
Well, I thought it was amazing. I thought it was really good. I like the ones where you
Matamori made this film and went to Finland, and he was like talking about what makes Finland good. And one of the things he said was pointed out was that in Finland you have to know the subject. You have to write out. There's no multiple choice. You have to write out. You make your own sentences.
And
what do you know?
And it's also So when discussing the questions that we put in the exam, I, unlike some lecturers, one of the principles that I use is that an expert in the field should be able to answer the question well, right? And so shouldn't have had to turn up to my field to answer the question. Right? So that way means I can't rely on knowledge for a particular book, because an expert might not have read that particular book. So an expert should be able to answer the questions. The questions have to be fairly open. I also don't like asking memory-based things, like remember the names of these three things. They'll say, right, these are three things, describe them.
Yeah.
Right? So it's more your understanding of the things rather than memory of the things. And yeah, we try and give the student the opportunity to express what they know, rather than catch them out on things they don't know.
Yeah, the confidence thing, I didn't enjoy that. What the hell am I supposed to write? I don't know how confident I am. I just go with whatever my gut tells me.
So you did an art degree, so I can talk to you about that. I didn't grade. So one of the things that I'm interested in is meta-knowledge, right? So one of the things that we do in the I have a multi-choice section, mainly so I can talk about meta-knowledge, which is I use. So there's three grading systems that you have for multi-choice. So you have 1-0, 1 minus like a quarter, and 1 minus 1, right? So this is the British system, and you probably have multi-choice systems. You both can have tests, but 1-0, this is the kind of more American. That means your average is 0,
okay.
Right? So the idea is that if you have 5 options, you lose a bit for every wrong answer.
Okay.
You end up with an average of 0 if you just answer C on it. Here you get an average of like 0.2 if you answer C on anything.
Okay.
And here, the German system, you end up with minus 4, minus 80%, because you get minus 1 for every wrong answer,
yeah.
And then you plus 1 for the right answer. So what I do is I actually turn these into 1.5 minus 1/2 and 2 minus 2. So the idea is you can take risks. And so if you are feeling sure of your answer, you can say, yep, I'm feeling sure of my answer. If I'm wrong, I'm going to lose money. Okay? And actually, strategically, you can work this out to be less than 50%. You say this one. Between 50 and 75%, you pick this one. And over 75%, you should pick this one. So that's the numbers that those represent. And it gives you choice about how well you know something. I also, did you use the bonus question, weak question feature as well?
I can't remember, so probably not.
So when out of those 6 questions that I asked you, they're all marked out of 10. One of them you can nominate to be out of 15, and one to be out of 5. So you pick your weakest question and say that's out of 5, and your strongest question and say that one's out of 15. And so it's unusual, but if you were someone who had 10 and didn't answer one of them, then you could maximum get 5 more marks by picking it correctly. Right? Usually a student who's able to get 10 on one of the questions can usually get about 5, at least on their worst one, right? It's unlikely that you're brilliant and completely in the air. And so usually it's only around like 3 marks of shift, but it still gives me an indication of you understanding what you know well and what you don't know so well. One of the ones I haven't been able to do yet, and I want to work out how to do this, is nominate another student. So for one of your answers, you get to nominate another student in class, and you get the maximum of their grade or your grade in that question. It's social knowledge, right?
Yeah.
It's the ability to get you, and part of that is to get students to then specialize in it. You and your friendship that, I'll do this thing, you do that thing, but we all take some responsibility for being expert in a particular area.
Mm-hmm.
Because because in reality, that's what happens in company. Right? It's not like you have to answer who's who first. If you go, well, you know, me smoke that, oh. So that knowledge is actually really useful in reality, but we tend not to assess it. And so I'm trying to find a way of assessing that. In the third year mobile course, we do a bonus mark for the hardest question in the exam and the easiest question in the exam for the class. So the only way to do well in that question is to know your class, right? And ask other people what they know. Right? So you have to work out what other people in the class know and don't know, and work out what's easy in our class. I'm giving addition grades for having the ability to understand other people. Yeah. Yes. So yes, I'm rewarding understanding other people. Not necessarily being social, but certainly talking to other people. I am rewarding. So yeah, but but all of those sit in that kind of meta knowledge area. They're knowledge about knowledge.
Yeah.
So, and you know, when you're programming, if you're going to comment code, you should comment code which is hard for other people to understand. So that's about the knowledge. When you write documentation, the extra work you put in is around things other people find difficult.
Yeah.
If you spend too much time explaining things that everyone understands, they'll start reading the documentation and give up and get bored. Right? And so if you explain nothing, then there's also people going to give up. So you have to find what are the interesting things to explain. So what are the challenging things that people might want to know? And so that's about understanding other people.
And then it's all about conflict as well, because if you're writing a comment on GitHub, there might be people who have no understanding of you whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might want to add extra comments, I would propose, because people can, if you...